In this episode of From Bench to Fireside, Pisces Chief Scientific Officer, Dr. John Connolly, talks with Dr. Robbie Masner, who is also an independent investigator at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. When conventional treatments for children battling deadly cancers fail, new discoveries can offer hope. Dr. Masner focuses on CAR T cell development both in the laboratory and in the clinic. In other words, he investigates treatments for pediatric diseases with a high unmet need. Get ready to go from bench to fireside with Dr. Masner to find out how his lab is tackling pediatric cancers that have long been overlooked.
So let's welcome Robbie Masner. Robbie's a physician scientist. He's focused on the development of completely novel CAR T therapies and new mechanisms improving cancer care, particularly in children with incurable diseases. And this is just an enormously important field, one that's essential to the Institute, essential to the Parker Institute. And it's an area that we want to not just continue to focus on, we really want to be able to advance and form a nucleating force. And experts like Robbie really do push this forward. So Robbie, I just want to say thank you so much for jumping on and talking about your research and about your role in the Parker Institute.
Sure. Thanks, John. I'm really happy to be here talking with you. Obviously, a big fan of all the work from the Parker Institute and the support over the years. So happy to be here together.
Yeah, it's great. It's a wonderful network, and it's really important to have both the diversity of expertise and really incredible leadership. It's going way back now. Why pediatric cancer care? This is something I think that it's close to everybody's heart. But it's one of the things that I think we don't have enough people that are really diving in there. So what brought you there? Why is it that you dedicated your life and your career to this?
Sure. I actually got into science because I became a pediatric oncologist and not the other way around. I went to college and was initially studying biology, working in a lab, and lasted about 18 months until I said, oh, this isn't for me. I'm never going to do it again. And went down the clinical route and went through the rest of college, med school, residency, until fellowship in pediatric oncology without ever touching a pipette again. And I was driven to pediatric oncology because I love kids. It's an amazing field. The cure rates are somewhere around 75%. Most patients do quite well, although at the cost of unfortunate late effects related to chemotherapy. And it's just a field that's been catapulted by collaborative research. I found that all pretty inspiring, and it led me to pediatric oncology. Then I became a fellow, and it's great. You learn how to take care of patients and with leukemia, solid tumors, and you can cure most of them. But then there's this subset of patients that have relapsed disease or metastatic solid tumors when you meet them, and you realize there was just nothing for these patients. And you just give them the same chemotherapy that we were giving patients with localized tumors, and a lot of toxicity without a lot of benefit for and definitely no long-term or almost no long-term cure for those patients. Right. And at the same time, I was in a pretty unique fellowship that was a joint program between Hopkins and the NIH. And at NIH, I was fortunate to help take care of the patients that were on their first trial, phase one of CD19 CAR in ALL. Right. And it was just amazing to see patients that had multiply relapsed leukemia, who we knew from our primary clinic, would have died from their disease if they hadn't gotten these therapies, and they were going into remission. And that was just really inspiring. And I said, this is so cool. CAR T cells are like science fiction. And my mentor at the time, Crystal Mako, who's the Pisces Center director at Stanford, she said, no, it's actually science, not science fiction. You should come to my lab and try it out. And that's where I got into pediatric oncology immunotherapy research.
Now, you couldn't have picked a better mentor. Crystal is so incredibly inspiring, such a great leader for the Pisces Center at Stanford and for the entire field. She's absolutely amazing. And it's just an incredible environment there, incredibly focused with experts with different technologies that are being cross-applied. And to be there at that time, applying to kids just makes a huge amount of sense. It's great. So where did your research take you then? So you're there, you're working, and what were you guys facing? One of the things that Crystal has talked about, and I've heard others say, and I think I've heard you say too, that kids aren't small adults, that these are totally different immune systems, things are quite different. And you really do have to go back to the fundamentals of immunology and really begin to understand that. This has been your experience, and what is it that you're working on now, and what are the challenges that you're facing?
Yeah, I think what you're alluding to is pediatric cancer and pediatric immunobiology is just completely different than adult cancer. So around the same time that CD19 CAR was really making waves in the heme malignancy space, checkpoint inhibitors were obviously coming to the forefront of melanoma, then lung cancer, and then almost many adult indications. And so also when I was a fellow, I remember I took care of patients that were on the first pediatric melanoma patients, which is quite rare, but they were on the first trial of ipilimumab that was happening in kids. And then eventually we saw PD-1 tested also. And those trials were mostly, unfortunately, negative, that there's almost no activity of these blockbuster immunotherapy drugs from adult cancer, almost no activity in kids. And why? Is because adult cancers or cancers in which the checkpoint inhibitors work are these high mutation burden driven by repeated environmental exposures. And the biology of pediatric cancer is different. It's a developmental disease, oftentimes driven by an epigenetic change or a single translocation. So there's not a lot of mutations for the T cells to respond to. Seeing that, and then also seeing CD19 CAR, which is really, as you introduced it, completely synthetic biology, taking a T cell that shouldn't be reacting against the B cell and just driving it to synthetically recognize it and kill the leukemia. And we realized this has to be the way forward in pediatrics, because the drugs that were being developed for adult solid tumor, for melanoma, et cetera, they weren't going to work in pediatrics.
Yeah. And I think that these first generation CAR, first, second, third generation CAR T therapies that are out there, again, primarily developed for adults and then repurposed back into pediatrics, they've had just incredible results. But you've always, one of the problems, of course, is targets, trying to find the right target. And is this something that you guys also face in the pediatric field? What are the right targets and what are the targets that are clean, so on the tumor, but not on normal tissue?
Yeah, for sure. It's a great question. So obviously in the heme malignancy space, the lineage derived antigen, CD19, BCMA, CD22, CD20, et cetera, they're perfect because they're on almost every cancer cell because they derive from the lineage, and you can live without the normal tissue, but I can't do the same thing if you're going after a liver tumor or a brain tumor, because lineage derived antigen tends to be on all the other cells in that same organ of interest. And actually this is something that's actually really lacking in the field, and a real true understanding of the biology of cancer targets. And because of that, in pediatrics, my lab's focus has actually largely been in a target that we've gone after for the last 25 years, which is a gangliosidase known as GD2. So this is a glycolipid or a sugar that's overexpressed on cancer, and no one really has fully understood why it's there. But when I was in my pediatric training, there was an approval of an antibody against GD2 for pediatric neuroblastoma. The target was first identified in the 1980s on both coasts, Lloyd Old at MSK and a group in California also, Boston, I think. But it took 30 years to get a drug approved. And it's interesting because it's a very pediatric specific target, in that when they tried to develop it for melanoma and other cancers, it didn't really work. So my lab, besides the CAR T-cell engineering, actually has a real big focus on understanding this molecule GD2. Why is it on the cancer? What regulates it? What happens when it goes away? And how can we more effectively target it? And it's been amazing to see. When I first got to Stanford, Michelle Manji's lab, who she's a neurobiologist and a cancer neuroscientist who studies a rare pediatric brain tumor, DIPG, her lab had just used a 250 antibody screen to see what was on the surface of their tumor models. And GD2, which was this target known in this other cancer, which is not a brain tumor, neuroblastoma, it actually turned out to be highly expressed across all DIPGs. And no one knew it was there. And part of the reason no one knew it was there is because it's a sugar. So it's not made like a typical protein. Right, and so if you look at the RNA-seq data, the ways we predict what's on the surface didn't say it was there. And she just happened to look. And then it was so satisfying that we were able to take GD2 CAR T cells that we already had, show that they worked in mice, and then eventually translate that to people and actually see clinical activity in humans, just because Michelle and her lab bothered looking.
Yeah, that's great. And your work trying to get to the heart of why it's different is really interesting. My assumption would be that there's some metabolism difference that leads to synthesis, but that it certainly doesn't align with why you're not seeing activity or even expression in adults, or at least activity in adults.
Yeah, the problem is, so GD2 is expressed on a whole lot of sarcomas, on melanoma, on some lung cancers, but then neuroblastoma, which is this pediatric peripheral nerve cell tumor, stood alone as the only place the antibody actually worked in. Okay. And I think there's two reasons for that. Number one, it actually was only tested. It didn't really work in neuroblastoma in bulk disease. It's only when they tested it in patients who had no evidence of disease and ran a randomized trial that they actually thought could be used as consolidation. So that's a very hard trial to use to do, especially when your agent has no activity in the kind of the upfront setting. They were able to see a little bit of activity previously in relapse disease. And so that they ran, took a risk and ran this randomized trial. But why, the other reason it probably uniquely works in neuroblastoma is that it's homogeneously expressed, because actually it's not fully understood why, but it's homogeneously expressed in neuroblastoma. And when you look at sarcoma samples, right, we've looked at primary samples, you get like a big smear of GD2 expression. And in neuroblastoma, it starts at least high and homogeneous. And the biology of DIPG, this other brain tumor that we've been targeting, is also such that it drives high and homogeneous expression. And in this case, my lab, working with Kim Stegmeier's lab, discovered that it's the epigenetic regulation of some of the enzymes that make GD2 that drive high expression in cancer. And DIPG, which is an epigenetically mutated cancer, therefore expresses high GD2 as a consequence of its oncogene.
So stepping back and this using GD2 as a model for target discovery and validation. So that's got to be something that's, and it's clearly one of the things that we know from heme malignancies versus solid tumors, is the uniformity, as you mentioned, uniformity of target expression is critical. And you just don't see that in a lot of these solid tumors, as heterogeneity is how it goes. But so I guess that would just be something when you're trying to define a completely novel target in a solid tumor, that anything that would have a uniform expression, obviously you want tissues, you know, tumor specificity, but uniform expression is essential. So when you're thinking about this, is that there's not too many things that are out there that are like that, that these are pretty unique situations. And maybe, as you said, tumor specific just to certain tumors. How do you think about using, not just using co-expression to, or I want to get to these concepts of barcodes for tumor specificity with the idea that there's really not too many that are just single letterbox signs that say you've arrived, but rather patterns that'll take you to the tumor that'll define if you have these three or these three, then this is a tumor. And again, tracing that back to molecular understanding of the pathways that lead to that expression, like epigenetics. How do you see that in terms of future targets, or should we keep searching for those GD2s?
Yeah, no, I think you're 100% right. It's going to be rare that we have something that's highly and homogeneously expressed in a cancer, especially something that is a downstream target of the oncogene or essential to the cancer, but not essential and expressed on normal tissue. There will be targets like that. I think we'll discover more of them as we understand more about integrins or the siloglycome, but I don't think there's going to be that many of them. So I think, yeah, you're going to need these combinations of antigens, and there's two ways you can think of combinations. You can say, okay, I'm going after gastric cancer and 60% of my cells express cladding 18.2. What is biologically different about those cells than the other 40% of the cells, and what defines those other 40% of the cells? So my lab is doing that with GD2. We're looking at GD2 heterogeneous cancers and trying to understand, are there other sugars that are expressed on the other ones that we also can target? And you think about a disease like neuroblastoma or even prostate cancer, small cell lung cancer, that you see a lot of state switch. The cancer biologist described that you get the cell state switch, the EMT, mesenchymal transition. The surface targets are going to change. And we see that in our mouse models with neuroblastoma, because we can induce state switch with CAR T cells. And what's on the surface totally changes. And that's gonna emerge in human studies for sure. And I think we really need to join up the cancer biologists and people who really understand this with the therapists. And that there you're going to have some really powerful synergy and collaboration to understand how to truly target cancer.
Yeah, I actually love this idea of looking at the non-protein targets that are on the surface. It undermines the concepts that all the RNA-seq that we've been doing forever solves everything, right? Because we've had it for a long time, and we haven't got there. So what about this idea of looking at previous therapies? So how does chemotherapy actually impact the tumor? And can you actually use that to generate, and particularly those that influence metabolism, influence methylation events, how you handle lipid oxidation and things like that? So is there any thought into looking at that, how previous chemotherapy impacts then the antigens that are on the surface of these tumor cells? And can you generate novel antigens that way?
Yeah, this is a great question. If cells avoid chemotherapy by changing their cell state or, exactly. or doing something else, putting some transporter on the surface, can you go after that transporter yes, exactly. And make it specific to resisting cancer cells? And we are so far, I think, from actually understanding this in primary human tissue samples yeah. at the protein level in relapse or in post therapy settings. It's a problem for the field actually. And it's most acute in pediatrics where we can't just, you actually can't consent in most cases, a child for an optional biopsy because there's some ethical issues there for someone that really can't give a consent that's under 18 years old. So many of our models come from samples that are pre-relapse. And yeah. the surfaceome might be completely different. Yeah. I'm sure the surfaceome is changing. The genetics are changing, right? The RNA is changing. I think you're right. The RNA-seq, it's a tool to get somewhere. But if we don't look at protein and the glycome, we don't really know what's on the surface. And
yeah, particularly when you're like one of the key characteristics of these cells is their metabolic difference. This is why you've got a tumor. And so that makes a huge amount of sense. It really does.
Yeah.
The other thing that you've got really tearing up in the lab is synthetic biology, obviously. So how do you think about that? How do you think about these modifications? It is like science fiction that you can go in and reuse tools of synthetic biology to repurpose the immune system. So what are you working on these days in the lab? And what are you thinking about in terms of synthetic biology and how are you using that to overcome some of the challenges we talked about?
Sure. I think what you're alluding to is that we recently published a paper looking at downstream signaling molecules to replace the kind of canonical CD3 zeta as the master switch of T cell signaling. And this was a project that honestly started by accident. We were trying to do something totally different, but we ended up making CARs that contained kinases or other signaling molecules from the T cell signaling pathway. And like they worked. So we skipped zeta. We basically bypassed some of the upstream signaling and we're able to start later in the signaling pathway. And so we first saw this with ZAP70, which is two steps past zeta. And we're really excited about our CARs that contain, the kinase domain from ZAP70 as the signal one, as the primary signaling protein. They seem in our animal models to have they're much less susceptible to tonic signaling and T cell exhaustion. And despite the fact that they're, let's say, less potent, they make less cytokine in vitro assays. In vivo, they almost always outperform our zeta CARs. We're really excited about understanding this and bringing this to the clinic. And that's shovel ready. We'll take a target like GD2 or B7H3 that we know there is some clinical activity ready with CAR T cells in the clinic in trials and, sure. and flip in a ZAP70. So it's one of the trials I'm most excited to do. And the biology around that is fascinating. Also, is it better just because there's less tonic signaling, or is it better because it's bypassing zeta and LCK, which are these upstream molecules, and so therefore also bypassing the cell's ability to inhibit those molecules?
Yeah, exactly.
So is it skipping a bunch of phosphatases and is basically right. short-circuiting the cell? But then downstream of ZAP70, the other thing we discovered was that the targets of ZAP70 is this beautiful two-member scaffold, LAT and SLP76, which kind of, when they come together, you recruit PLC gamma and the T cell signals. And when we saw the ZAP70 CAR worked, we realized, hey, maybe we could get a T cell to work just by bringing together a LAT and SLP76.
Yeah.
And it surprisingly worked. It was very leaky. We started thinking about making a Boolean logic AND gate, so a T cell that would only respond when both antigens were present. I was initially very leaky, and it took about 2 years to really engineer the system to be clean and potent. And it was cool because all of the engineering ultimately derived from papers we read in basic biology.
Yeah.
So we went back to things published by Art Weiss at UCSF, Larry Samuelson at NCI, all the individuals that defined the basic biology of these molecules.
Absolutely.
20 years ago, before they had CRISPR, before they even had viruses to make a lot of these, everything done in transfection, reconstitution experiments, and they figured out exactly what each piece of these proteins do. So we were able to basically use that knowledge in order to build these new receptors, which was really fun. And we're hopeful now we've got this great Boolean logic AND gate, and we're hopeful now we've got to do a lot of work on the target discovery to understand sure. how things are actually uniquely expressed on cancer together, but not together on a normal tissue. And we're doing some of that work also.
Absolutely. I think I love this because it does go back to, like you said, that some of the old ideas of deconstructing how nature naturally works and actually trying to create the biology that you're looking for using the tools of nature. And I think it's more of a classic way of thinking about it and doing it when it comes to synthetic biology. These days, I think we're getting a lot of this real synthetic biology where we have the ability to screen 100 million possible combinations. And so now we're using machine learning to try to come up with novel signaling. And I think it's great. It's super interesting. I think I would just do that the rest of my life if I could just play around like that. But when it comes to moving that cell into an immune system in which the outcome you're looking for is a durable response, which is an emergent behavior in a complex system, which requires lots of different cells in communication. I think going back to how the nature naturally works using those tools is probably your best first bet from that standpoint. But I'd love to hear your views on it.
Yeah, I would agree with you, but I may agree with you just because the machine learning stuff is so complicated and I don't understand it. So I feel like I have to play in this space. It keeps things more simple and pared down. But yeah, I think the cell was designed to work a specific way. And if we can use the tools that are within that cell, it may be better. Now you can argue, what's the difference? You're already manipulating zeta in a car and that works. You're manipulating this. You could use a completely synthetic protein. And it's hard to look at a Dave Baker paper and not be like, oh, he's going to put us all out of business at some point. Of course, you have to deal with the immunogenicity of foreign protein, of completely synthetic proteins. For us, it's really been fun and fruitful to look at the natural proteins and how they work and see if we can manipulate them in some way. And a lot of the machine learning papers, they do that also. They use motifs from a lot of different types of signaling proteins and try to work off of that. But the other thing I keep saying about this paper, what I love about it is that it has the implications for T-cell engineering and immune cell engineering, but you got to wonder what other type of synthetic receptors could you make in any other type of cell, islet cells, HSC, something that uses the internal machinery like a kinase from the cell and hijacks that function into a service receptor. I'm hopeful my lab really focuses on cancer and immune cells, but I'm hopeful someone takes that up and sees that this can be applied to other cell types also.
Oh, for sure. No, it's great. It's an excellent point. And I think as we, particularly as fields like iPSC derived cell type fields begin to move forward, where you can begin to engineer things like hepatocytes and do some really interesting things, you can begin to think about cell factories and completely synthetic biology. I think it's awesome. Okay, just Robbie, one other point. I think you've recently moved to Dana-Farber. This is a recent start of your lab and getting things going there. So what attracted you to Dana-Farber? We love it. I think it's the premier translational center that we have within the PiSEE network. But what was it that brought you there that really attracted you to that environment?
Yeah, definitely can't say the weather.
Yeah.
In California. No, I'm really excited to be here at Dana-Farber relaunching my lab here, but also launching a clinical program that we hope will really be impactful. Dana-Farber is obviously an amazing cancer institute. The referral base is huge, both on pediatric in a joint venture with Boston Children's Hospital, but also on the adult side. And they've done great work in CAR T cells with commercial products and industry sponsored, but there hasn't been much investigator initiated CAR trials here yet. And it was a big focus of the administration to do this. And now you see other Parker members also here, Eric Smith, who on the adult side worked previously in myeloma, now doing also solid tumors, Rizwan Rome, who does NK cells, and a bunch of other investigators. And they're trying to put together or have put together, hopefully, a critical mass of investigators. And joined us with an amazing GMP. The CMCF here at Dana-Farber, they make CAR T cells for a bunch of companies. There's several products that are doing great in the clinic that's got their start with CMCF manufacturing. And so having all the pieces here, the administration really wanting this to push forward the field, plus CMCF, plus really dedicated investigators, plus, like I mentioned, an amazing referral base of patients. I feel like all the pieces are here for us to build a program that really is going to push the field forward.
That's fantastic. It really is. And I think that the environment, the investigators that you mentioned and many others, the leadership there is just so incredibly supportive and that vision that they have to really build this out. You are more than a perfect fit. I think the cell therapy there, building that whole program out with your colleagues is phenomenal. And we want to be part of it as Parker Institute. We want to continue to support and push that as best we can. So one other question too is I think you mentioned Crystal and she's just such a wonderful mentor. Throughout your career, could you maybe talk a little bit about some of the mentors that you've had that have taken you to the point you're at? And then also, I'm going to hit you with your lab strategy, recruiting all these new students and postdocs. What is it? What's your philosophy on mentorship of scientists?
Sure. First, talking about mentors, I have to talk about Crystal. She really taught me to be a scientist, but also taught me to be a clinical investigator. And at NIH, it's funny, like when I went out into the world after my fellowship and started going to a lot of conferences, people would be like, oh, you can't have a lab and do clinical investigation. And that's the opposite of what everyone does at NIH and that we saw at pediatric oncology branch. I just thought it was amazing that you can make something in the lab and bring it to patients. And that's really the driving goal there. And Crystal brought that to Stanford. And I think that's spreading.
Crystal's absolutely incredible. And you've had such an amazing, just such an incredible clinician scientist, amazingly fortunate. I can tell you, and I've told her the same, that it's a privilege to work with her and just to see her in action is amazing. But now you've had your lab at Stanford, you've moved the lab here, now you're building it out. What is it that you take then? What's your philosophy in terms of these young scientists that are coming up and young clinician scientists particularly, to try to impart that kind of passion that you have?
Yeah. So I think there's kind of two parts to the question. One is who we take in the lab, and then there's also, which includes scientists and physician scientists. And I do want to say for scientists in the lab, actually at Stanford, what I witnessed were always the best postdocs is you take someone that's an expert in something totally different and bring them into a lab that is really good at something.
Right.
And try to let them stay out of their way as much as you can. Hard to do for a junior investigator, but let them basically figure out how to use what they have and use what they know and use what you have to shape something great. And that's where I think there's going to be a lot of synergy, taking CAR T cells with people of expertise in cancer biology or in vivo LNPs and in vivo delivery, all different types of things. So that's what I hope to really shape in the lab. The fellowship programs here at Dana-Farber, both pediatric hemonc and then also adult med onc, have a great reputation and a huge tradition of training physician scientists. And I hope this program will give many of those an outlet to both do science and bring it to patients. So that's hard to do for a lot of things that aren't synthetic biology or aren't cell therapy. A small molecule, you'll always end up going through some company in between. You get your kind of prototype molecule, and then they do their huge drug screens, and then they find. And so to take it from bench to bedside, that's a real odyssey that'll send you out into industry and then back. And it's hard to do. Even biologics, first batch of your biologic probably costs four times what your cell therapy trial will cost.
Yeah, for sure.
So I hope to people will be inspired to have that opportunity to say, oh, wow, this is something I made with my own hands and actually can bring it to the patient population that I treat, whether it be pediatrics or adult. And I think that really helps inspire people to work hard towards their goal.
Absolutely. That's great. It's really fantastic. So just to finish things off, just one quick question on the Parker Institute in general. Could you maybe talk a little bit about your interaction with PICE and how that's impacted your career?
Sure. Yeah. I remember when I was leaving NIH to go to Stanford. So I was finishing my fellowship. There was an article in the New York Times or Washington Post when you guys first got started. And I sent it to Crystal. I'll be like, oh, is this coming? Is the lab going to be associated with this? She was like, yes, I'll be the program lead. And so I say that to say from the day that I got to Stanford and I was an instructor or postdoc then in Crystal's lab for a few more years, PICE was influencing everything that we did, from the other labs that we were able to link up with, the ones inventing all the high throughput single cell technologies. And from that to what is our translational pipeline? How does that fit into the goals of Parker in brain tumors or other cancers? It affected everything that we did and how we approach things. And actually, it really reinforced, even though it really just reinforced the translational nature of the lab, the merging of basic biology with the translational nature. And then I was thrilled when I got my own lab and the calls came from you guys to say, okay, we want you to join as a member. And it was really, for me, a vote of confidence that we could do unique engineering in my lab that really differentiated us from other groups and that we fit in within that group. And so I've been happy. I think it's been a little bit over maybe two to three years now that I've been a member. And then fortunately also getting to do that here at Dana-Farber. The network is incredible. You have everything at the retreats, right? You have basic cancer biologists. You have Dave Baker doing synthetic protein engineering. You got CAR T cell translational people. And to put them all in a room together and have ideas thrown around is great. And then also just the access to the clinical data and the science so much earlier because everyone's so open about sharing. This is what working on our trial. This is what we changed in our manufacturing. And how you see those changes percolate among the groups has really been incredible.
Robbie, when you think about drug development in pediatric cancer, where do you see things going?
Yeah, so the advances that I mentioned in pediatric oncology, they really were realized just through combination chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery. And that's mainly how pediatric oncology got to go from a cure rate of 5% to a cure rate of 75%. But outside of those kind of traditional cytolytics, cytotoxics, there haven't been many drugs developed. There's a few exceptions, Kymriah, the CD19 CAR, anti-GD2 antibodies. And drug development is actually very difficult in pediatrics. So if you think about kind of our typical solid tumor, let's say bone sarcomas, we have about 1,000 patients a year, 70% are cured with chemotherapy. So somewhere around 200 to 300 patients with relapse disease a year. And if you imagine developing drugs specifically for that indication, there's a market failure there because there's not enough patients to get biotech to take real risks. And say, I'm going to develop specifically for this indication. What we're left with are two models. Number one, and it's most of what we do now, is waiting for drugs that come down the pike of adult oncology. And you could use PD-1 as an example. It's a huge blockbuster in adult oncology. I think it was approved before the phase one ever started in kids, unfortunately. But then it just doesn't work in most pediatric settings because the biology is different. Same with EGFR inhibitors. The biology isn't there. To support those drugs that have been very impactful in adult oncology. And then even when there is some biology there, my personal experience has been going to some of these companies, even when they get an FDA approval, so they're not even at the small biotech stage, they have an FDA approved agent in a big company, they're generally disinterested in running these trials. And forget running the trials, providing us the drug. I submitted an LOI recently for an epigenetic inhibitor to combine with immunotherapies. And it's an FDA approved agent. And the company said, our interest lies within the adult population. Yeah. The other model of what we need to do is get drugs into our own hands and clinically de-risk these drugs. And what I mean there is prove that they have a activity in pediatrics. Yeah. And then it becomes a better proposition for the company to actually develop this to become a drug. And we can use Kymriah as an example. Kymriah's first indication was in pediatric ALL. I'm not sure it would have been developed if it also wasn't trying to get an indication in adult DLBCL. Yeah. Anti-GD2 antibody, so dinutuximab was the first one. It was a phase 3 trial run by the NCI who made the drug themselves and totally de-risked it and then licensed it to a company. And that's the way it is for very small markets. It's very hard for especially a small biotech to take a huge risk, a huge bet, a very expensive trial on a drug that won't ultimately make that much money. So I think instead it's our responsibility as pediatric oncologists to figure out how to clinically de-risk drugs within academia. And everything that all the experience I've had thus far is CAR T cells are the best way to do that because we can invent them and make them in our GMP and bring them to patients.
Absolutely. Now, cell therapy really holds an enormous problems in pediatrics, and it's something that you and Crystal and many others are really driving for, but it's so complicated in this setting. But thank you. That's incredible. I just want to just thank you for taking the time to talk to me today and to talk to all of us about the great work you're doing and just wish you luck on the new lab and pushing off. I know you're going to do great things. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Thank you and to Pisces for all the support. It's been a lot of fun, and I'm sure it'll continue to be.
Thanks for listening to From Bench to Fireside, and special thanks to this season's PICE Network contributors from Dana-Farber, UCSF, Stanford Medicine, Mount Sinai, UCLA, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and Weill Cornell Medicine. To donate to support PICE's mission, please visit parkerici.org/donate. You can find From Bench to Fireside on Spotify. To be notified of new episodes, like or subscribe to our channel. For the latest at the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy, follow us on X and LinkedIn at ParkerICI or visit www.parkerici.org to learn how we aim to accelerate the development of breakthrough immune therapies to turn all cancers into curable diseases. From Bench to Fireside is produced by the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy. All content and opinions expressed in this podcast belong solely to the Parker Institute. From Bench to Fireside is a trademark of the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy. We'll see you next time as Parker Network experts in immunotherapy take you from behind the lab bench to the frontiers of cancer research.